talk about the most exciting original motion picture of all time.
You know, that's that is a selling point on the actual poster, which is ironic because it's not an original picture. It's a remake. What?
They don't know that. Audience is thick.
Look, I understand this. We're talking 1976, way before the age of social media and home video and all that business. But people knew what the hell King Kong was. That's why they came out with a new movie, a new version of King Kong, which we are talking about tonight. David Fowley, I am holding up your Blu-ray version.
That's
of King
where it
Kong.
Is.
Yes. from Scream Factory put this out a little while ago, yeah. And you were gracious enough to lend it to me. I'd never seen this movie before.
Wow.
Spoiler alert. Look, I have never seen the original King Kong either.
Whoa.
I think I own it on Blu-ray, but I've never watched it. My only experience with King Kong have been these god-awful new versions that have come out. And watching King Kong 70... Oh, I'm sorry, the Peter Jackson version, which...
That was good.
Well, I would go so far as to classify that as one of the god-awful versions. I hated that movie. Maybe it's time to rewatch it. Maybe I need to see the original in order to appreciate it. Don't know, but when I was watching, I was like, why is this 7.5 hours long, and what's with the ice skating and sliding across the rink in the park?
Yeah, it was too long. I'll say that.
Although I did like Naomi Watts. She had a great presence.
She was fantastic. And I like what they did with Jack Black, and it was too long. I think that there's a reason that, it continuously, it's a done deal. People are going to go see a movie about King Kong. It's just, that's why they keep remaking.
Well, it seems like it's one of those, not so much that it's about the beloved character, because the story is kind of always the same. I mean, they're branching out a little bit in these modern versions where he's like fighting Godzilla and stuff, but it's basically a giant ape is discovered on a mysterious island and doped up and taken back to New York, where it goes on a rampage. And it climbs the Empire State Building in, 1976. It climbs the Twin Towers. And then I can't remember, did they do the Empire State Building in Peter Jackson's version?
I think they did. That's what this poster in the 70s was, iconic, man. I don't know if you could see it. So you see the and it was just like, I think my dad had it up in the garage or something.
Really?
And I was like, but it's artwork, right? It's not Photoshop, it's not whatever photos, And I always remember as a kid, I'm like, man, he's balancing his feet on the Twin Towers. Look at that front foot. I don't know if that's accurate, like anatomically, but.
No, because I think there's a scene actually where he jumps between the towers or something.
Does he barely make it or something?
Right. So it's a little forced perspective. But no, what I was getting at is that it's a movie that lends itself to the state of the art of movie special effects. Yeah. It was certainly the case of, Harryhausen back in the 30s. And then you've got the effects team in the 70s, where it's a giant, a more realistic, an animatronic with the rear projection and things. Mm-hmm. And of course you're going fully digital in 2006 with Peter Jackson. And nowadays, like, everything is just CG and these amazing wonders. But what struck me about King Kong 76 was the modern complaint about the new spate of films is we spend too much time with uninteresting characters and not enough time watching the big monsters fight.
Yeah.
The trio in the 76 version of Jeff Bridges playing this environmentalist scientist who stows away aboard the ship that's going to Skull Island, Charles Grodin as the industrialist, oil exec, mid-level oil exec who's going out there to find oil and ends up finding a giant monkey, and then Jessica Lange as the aspiring starlet who they discover on this, adrift at sea when the yacht she was on exploded. These three actors are so great in this movie. They have such a weird chemistry that I lament the fact that there aren't like a filmography of 50 great wacky screwball comedies involving these characters. And that's not to say they're all screwball in this movie, but they just have that dynamic where I just want to watch them do anything.
Well, they're great. I mean, and this is the debut of Jessica Lange. I mean, what what a movie. I mean, to debut with King Kong. Yeah, it's these three are really great. And I think, like, for those, I think this, it was either, yeah, this was probably for me at this age, you know, I was, gosh, I was, when this came out, I was like 5 or 6. I think I didn't see it in the theater, but I saw it at, like, the ABC Sunday night movie of the week, you know. You know, and the ABC cut was a little longer than the theatrical, but I remember just being transfixed, my young eyes on Jessica Lange, but just transfixed in general over just like King Kong. And, you know, because I had never, at that age, I had never seen the original. So this was my King Kong that I grew up with. And that was my first, you know, exposure to Charles Grodin, Jeffrey, these three actors. And so, you know, it's cool watching it. I was really hesitant. I mean, I knew that I wanted to buy it, but I was really hesitant to see, is this viewing at this age, at 49 years old, is this going to tarnish how I felt about it? And I'm like, no, it just, you know, I was more, and I, now I didn't, I watched, I think, just the theatrical cut.
Yeah, me too.
So I wouldn't mind going back and seeing, you know, how much more is in the television version. But yeah, I mean, I just, obviously I've seen a lot of movies since then. And so I have probably a greater appreciation for what was done with the material for the time, you know, in the mid 70s. And, you know, the fact that Rick Baker is walking around in a Kong outfit, I mean, that's pretty awesome. Yeah, it wasn't tarnished at all. It felt cool to watch. It was almost like this nostalgic, you know, trip going back to, part of me was watching it with the eyes of, you know, young David, but I had definitely a better appreciation for, like, the cinematography. I was reminded of the great John Barry score. And yeah, just these characters are just fun to hang out with, and how they're able to, they take a bit of a Jaws approach with the, you don't see Kong for a while. And it makes sense considering their limitations and what they had to work with. But I really appreciate this movie. I don't understand. I know a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, this is a terrible movie. The sequel's bad, and I haven't seen it, but they actually did make a sequel that came out in the '80s to this. Yeah.
Did anybody come back for it?
I want to say, I'm not going to speak for that. I'm not sure. I want to say somebody did. It wasn't Bridges, Lang, or Grodin. And I don't know if it was the director. It might have been the director. But I'm curious. You know, like I said, I envy you. Like, this is your virgin screening. I mean, what did you think?
First of all, I was reminded what a PG movie is today versus what a PG movie was back in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, as sexy as Jessica Lange was in this movie, and definitely the camera, the crewmates, the Kong, everybody was just ogling Jessica Lange. And there was such a tease that it was almost embarrassing. But also, there was a part of me that I'll be the pig. I was grateful because we see, we see what was hidden underneath that top, it was a very brief flash. But I was like, this was a PG movie, and they showed it on television. What the
hell? Well, I wonder if that was cut out in the televised version. But, and especially, it was like, this is released in December, so it's like, they're promoting it for, like, Christmas. Spend Christmas with Kong. Oh, well, what's this?
Well, the Peter Jackson version was a December. That was a That's holiday right. release too.
That's right.
Remember that. Which may explain why the ice skating rink and all that, or the frozen lake, I guess, frozen pond. I like some of the supporting cast that show up in this. Rene Auberjonois, Odo from Deep Space Nine. Yeah. He has a great character. He's like the surveyor, and he gets to laugh in Charles Grodin's face when because Grodin is going out there. He's like, this is going to make me so rich, and I can't wait to exploit all this oil. And he said you needed to, it needs a little bit more time to cook before it's ready. How long? And Rene Aubergin wants 10,000 years. He's like, in geological terms, it'll be tomorrow. And then also John Randolph, who I recognized as one of the grandparents in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, played the ship captain. And was it Jack O'Halloran, Non from Superman 2? And here's the problem. And this is one of the benefits of going back and watching this movie after having a lifetime of other movies. I expected this guy, like, oh, cool, he's like a main character. Not so much. He is unceremoniously dumped down a chasm. Like, why did they do? Oh, that's because he wasn't non yet.
Yeah, and he was non. He was one of the first actors you see in the movie too, like on that shipping yard when they're getting ready to load the boat and everything. And you know, even I didn't catch this, but I'm looking at Wikipedia, and it's saying that Corbin Burnson and Joe Piscopo play reporters number 1 and 2, respectively.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where were there even reporters in this movie?
I think probably once they went back to New York or something, maybe.
Oh, that giant crowd scene around there's a lot of press in the latter part of this movie when they get
in. And we also see Ed Lotter, a great character actor, kind of like in the vein of a Terry O'Quinn or something, and he's one of the first mates. It's a cool crew. You know, you could compare it to, Peter Jackson's version, and you don't have like Andy Serkis chewing scenery as the cook.
It's kind of a goofy group of characters, but they're goofy just because they're different personality types. They're not trying to, show each other up.
Right.
And what I loved about it is sort of like Alien, where it's a movie that is about a particular group of people doing a particular thing.
Sure.
And then life gets in the way and completely diverts the entire rest Jurassic of the story. Park. What? No, life
finds a way.
Life gets in the way. There you go.
Okay.
But no, you know what I'm saying? Like this, yeah. I could have watched an entire movie about Grodin just trying to go get oil, and then Jeff Bridges trying to, stop him. Like, they discover natives on the island. That's right. The first, kind of clue that things are not going to go the way that they had planned. Oh, and then it turns out, oh, they all are in fear worship of this giant mutant ape. And then everything else happens. I loved that, Grodin's oil plot falls through, but then he's like, I'm gonna bring back a giant ape, and it's gonna be a mascot, and it's gonna be perfect. The climax, or I guess the pre-climax, where they have this giant show where they get a couple of black people dressed up in the native garb running Jessica Lange up a ramp to tie her to this silver garland post to replicate what happened to her on the island as a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And then the door opens up and you expect to see King Kong, but because it's an oil company, it's a giant gas pump. Like a 50-foot tall gas pump is rolled out to the middle. Yeah. And then that gets lifted up, I guess, by helicopter or something. And then you have Kong in a cage wearing a giant crown. Yes.
It's like kind of
wearing a gold crown with the oil company logo on it. I'm like, this is satire, social commentary on a level that I yelled to get my wife back in the room because she had kind of tuned out. She's like, what is this? And I said, no, you have to see this. And I rewound it. And she was like, oh my God.
Now, was she rolling her eyes at Jessica Lange's part as much as my wife was?
Yeah, she wasn't into it. It's a very fine line. We were kind of communicating about this because I watched this in two parts. Like, I watched part of it on Friday and the other part like two nights ago. But Jessica Lange's character, she's not exactly a sex pot. She's not a ditz, but she's a very much her own type of person. And it's in the vein of this Marilyn Monroe, kind of an aspiring starlet who's got the breathless voice, and she's kind of trying to figure out her place in the world. Is she in love with Jack, the Jeff Bridges character? Is she willing to sacrifice that for a career? Does she love the monkey? It's all very confusing, but it works, and it really shouldn't.
Does she love the monkey? Tune in at 11. Yeah, I think there is a bit of a ditch to the way it's written, but not the way it's portrayed. And here's what I mean. Yeah. It's like, you know, her character's name is Dawn, not Dawn. To be unique, it's the two letters in the middle are flipped. I'm like, that's just dumb. they changed the AW. Dawn. Yeah, it's just like,
Because I wonder if that's, you know, there should have been a line in there about, did she switch that around when she moved to Hollywood or whatever? Or right. Was that just her parents being like, you're going to be different?
I hope it's the former. Yes. I like how, I mean, all the guys who are on the ship, I mean, once they rescue her, it's like, when's the last time these guys have seen a woman? Because they're all like, ugh. You know, and, you know, I like how all the characters are introduced, because like Jeff Bridges is basically a stowaway on the ship because he knows where where the ship is going. And he knows about this island that's surrounded by this mysterious fog. But all of them, all the guys, when they meet, you know, Dawn, it's just so weird. They're all just kind of like, you know, Jeff Bridges does a great job. Even he is kind of like speechless. I mean, she takes full advantage of that, you know, meaning, you know, she knows the impact she has on these guys. And there's almost this power, you know, that she is used to, you know, and she sees the way they're reacting. And he even has that speechless moment when she comes to in the cabin where he's just like, it's because it's almost like, who is this person? Why is she, how is she out here? This is amazing. It's like, what the heck?
Well, yeah, because even the story of how she came to be, like she was on this yacht of this person who was, I guess, a sleazy film producer who was going to put her in a movie or something, allegedly. Yeah. And she went above deck when things got a little dicey. And that's when something blew up on the ship. And one of the things I love is that they don't try and tie it back to Kong. Like he was out for a swim and he batted the boat on accident or something, or a giant pterodactyl from the island swept in. It's just, it was just an accident. And she happened to end up, it's just this really weird detail that's not connected to anything. So there's mystery surrounding even that aspect of the movie.
Yeah. I remember seeing, you know, the Peter Jackson's version, once you get to Skull Island, he spends a lot of time on Skull Island. And that's fine. I mean, that's totally up Peter Jackson's alley. I mean, I get it. It's almost like a horror version of Jurassic Park. If you could, get even more horrific than Jurassic Park. But yeah, you do get kind of, Peter Jackson gets a lot more gruesome. But, you know, when the Skull Island that I was introduced to, that I grew up with, was this one. And they don't really name it. They do mention Skull Island, the name a little bit, but it is kind of really cool the way it's filmed and the way we're introduced to that geographic location, you know, the mist coming out of the mist, and that amazing, beautiful shot when she's running on the beach, just that, I mean, I think it was filmed in Hawaii, but it's just like, it's breathtaking because the camera just opens up and you just see how small these people are and how big the island is, even without a Kong next to them. It's just like, this is just tremendous.
And another parallel back to Alien. I mean, these came out, I think, the same year. Or no, Alien was 79, wasn't it?
Yeah,
79. So I don't know if there was any kind of influence there, but the idea of this crew discovering something on this completely uncharted land, when they come across the wall, it very much is a moment, almost even in the framing of the crew of the Nostromo coming across the derelict ship.
Yeah.
And just this giant kind of, it's not abandoned, but there's no activity around it until they actually get in and they find, there's a ritual going on.
They hear the music, I think. Yeah.
Right. And I think it's treated well. I could see it, you know, some people interpreting this as being offensive, but I mean, it's just a lost tribe of, you know, unknown origin having a ritual, and I think they hold their own against the the invaders. It's tasteful. I think it's pretty tastefully done.
No, I think so. I mean, you could easily go there and say, oh boy. But it is, look, it is the 70s, and there is a little bit of like a hippy dippy groovy man, you know, feel to this movie. Even in like some of the dancing scenes, in the native village, and definitely in Jeff Bridges' hair, the bearded Jeff Bridges' hair. Yeah, man. But even in like the conservativeness of, say, Grodin's character, he's got the little handkerchief always tied around.
Little ascot,
the little ascot thing. And, you know, and you could tell, okay, like, because I think I was watching like this and like some of the Planet of the Apes movies at that time. And it's just like, you know, it's all, you know, sci-fi ape stuff. But you saw a lot of like in the 70s, you saw a little bit of the pop culture and the decades in the decade that they were made in these movies. I appreciate the fact that this could have gone what Jackson did, is they could have gone into like, they could have made it a period piece, and they could have made it, you know, back in, you know, set the movie back in the 30s or something. But I like the fact that it is in the, you know, mid to late 70s, and, you know, what would happen? Why would they be taking back this ape? Well, to commercialize it, you know, and to capitalize on it.
Right. Even beyond the idea of, you know, most movies of this kind, where you're dealing with a creature, it's to turn into a weapon or to experiment on or whatever. Yeah. He just straight up wanted to turn into a corporate mascot. Yeah, we're going to have the biggest mascot, you know. And even with the natives, I think there's a great line where they're on their way back to America. Kong is in the cargo hold, and Bridges is lamenting the fact that they have essentially taken the god away from this people. And Grodin's like, they'll get over it. I mean, we just took this giant monkey away that terrorizes their women and causes all this havoc. And he's like, no, in like 10 years, they're just going to be a bunch of lost alcoholics. Which it's kind of in, I don't know if it's an insensitive line or it's meant to kind of touch on this idea of the realism of this invading force coming and taking away a significant piece of the culture and purpose of people that they don't even try to understand. You know, you could look at that as, you know, we're talking about the environmentalism of the 70s and sensitivity to Native American cultures. I think there's sort of an allegory there, and they don't make a big deal out of it, but that line is there. So you can think about it if you want to.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's the whole, you know, white man capitalism type thing. And yeah, these people are, we did them a favor, right? We took away the threat, you know, that, but, you know, what Bridges said is that it having this kind of god creature on this island to essentially, as we learn in Kong Skull Island, the not so long ago new version, is Kong is there to keep things in place, you know, to be the top dog. And so in a way, Kong's deal is, you give me a pretty girl to hang out with, because it's not like he's eating these people, you know, but you give me a pretty girl to hang out with, and I'll keep the island in check. I'll rip apart some snakes, giant snakes and this and that, and, you know, keep you safe.
And even that part is not really discussed in this film. Again, it's something you think about afterwards,
right?
Because
it's not, but it's kind of, you know, you think about it because it's almost like this unspoken deal that they have.
Right. But even that, in terms of the bargain, I don't know what he does to these women, you know, because I don't know how often this, well, and I'm sorry, the look on the animatronic face is very much literally like, oh,
Rick Baker, like, you dirty boy.
Yeah. You're like, you making eyes at this woman. I don't know what's going on, but, it's unclear how often this ritual takes place. Is it once a year? Is it once every 10 years? Is it once a week? But then as far as that bargain, I like that theory, because later on we discover a giant mutant snake that Kong has to wrestle. So it is feasible that this is sort of like his protection money is these young tribal women. But then it also opens up the question, like, what else is on this island? We've only seen a very small part of it. And I know Peter Jackson, like, there's giant spiders and, like, later on there's...
Brontosauruses and T-Rexes.
And mutant creatures or whatever.
Centipedes,
But it's left to our imagination. Like, it's almost like if there was a sequel where they, like, if they had struck oil, what would the developers have run into when they went there to try and set up derricks and industry?
No kidding. As far as getting off the island, I think even as a kid, I had a problem with this movie, and I had a problem with what they did with the Peter Jackson movies. There's a quick cut from like knocking Kong gas in this movie. They gas him out and knock him out. And then next thing you know, he's in the hull of the ship. Hold on. How did they get him there?
I think they called in some helicopters because they call in the helicopter. Okay. I have a bigger problem with the way they knock Kong out because they have jets or helicopters come in and they have these giant barrels of what turns out to be chloroform. Mm-hmm. And they set these barrels down inside a giant...
They dig a hole, yeah.
Yeah, they dig a hole and they put some like matting on top of it so he falls into it and the canisters explode. There's so much chloroform in there that knocks out a giant ape, and yet everybody, like, they approach the pit to make sure that he's in there. They see the giant hand in there. That would have knocked everybody out.
Nobody's possibly wearing killed gas them. Masks.
Right. Like, how did that work?
It's only for apes. It only works for apes.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great moment, too. Like, and again, it made me appreciate, like, what they did for the time that this movie was made, is that shot with the hand going up. You know that is just a hand. Like the rest of his body isn't in there. And that's what a lot of this movie is about. Like Jessica Lange, basically her co-star was a giant gorilla hand.
Right.
You know, and, you know, I think that there was I don't know if it was in one of the special features or something I read about it, is that, like, one of her first scenes, she was totally freaked out by the hand because at one point it wouldn't let her go. It just kept on squeezing, and they had to, like, so she was horrified. And they had to convince her, oh, you know, it's going to be, we're going to work on it. It's going to be better. It's like,
that sounds like a proto Me Too story of just like this, like a great metaphor of a giant hand grabbing a woman and not letting go.
That gorilla hand, right?
But yeah, I want to talk a bit about the special effects here.
Yeah.
This is sort of, I think it's a great Blu-ray. It's a great transfer, but it sort of suffers from the problem of, you know, some of these old movies, I think, are meant to be seen on a big screen in an old theater where it doesn't have that feeling of high definition, because everything that was rear projection, everything that was like cut out, like when Jeff Bridges is on the, you know, in the chasm, everyone else has been, you know, rocked off of that giant log, and Kong is trying to claw at him. You could see where they cut out that little bit, and it's just like this little bit of, you know, animated film stuck into the side of the mountain. Like, oh no.
Yeah.
It's charming, but it takes me out of the movie.
And some of the last, like, maybe 10, 15 minutes of the movie where he's up on the skyscrapers of New York is like, yeah, some of that's a little
Like the helicopters flying behind him, it's just like going in a straight line behind his back. And, you know,
I mean, honestly, at that point there really isn't any dynamism as far as, you know, the way the camera is moving, you know, in those, you know, at night, you know, New York scenes. Again, what I kind of tend to take notice of, not necessarily roll my eyes at, but take notice of, is like when there's a movie with that's reliant on special effects, some of the times when the, you know, the easy way out is to film, have the scene take place at night, you know?
Yeah.
The interesting thing with this is, and I watching this again, I was reminded of how I noticed this as a child is that I like the idea of Kong in this foreign territory, and he looks up at the sky to try and find some familiarity, and he sees the twin towers that looked like these twin mountain peaks, right? and the moon, you know, and it seemed like way too convenient to me this time watching it that like Jeff Bridges would do A plus B. Oh, I know where he's going. He's going to go with where, what, something, whatever is familiar, and he's going to go because he sees it. So he thinks Kong's going to see it. And so, oh, he's going to go to World Trade Center. I'm like, okay.
I've got a bigger issue. Look, the more we talk about this movie, the more it starts to fall apart. But just in the moment, I didn't care. But
yeah,
but
I didn't either.
Where, it's just... like Kong starts rampaging through New York.
Oh, I know what you're going to talk about.
Well, I think possibly the scene where Bridges and Lang go into that bar and she's left alone. And then the giant silent Kong hand comes in and grabs her. And not only that, but when we get out to the street and we see the arm pulling out, you realize it was almost like a subterranean bar, like a Cheers or something. Yeah, so like how
downstairs.
Yeah. On top of that, his face was staring through the window. So it's like he would have to like Elastic Man or something going around.
It's a big city. How did he find her? I mean, does she smell? I don't know. It's like,
he would know.
Yeah, exactly. That moment reminded me of some kind of like SNL spoof or something, you know, and that's when SNL was kind of like in its heyday, right? So it's like I could see like Chevy Chase or something.
Like the giant, like the shark at the shark at the door bet. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, these are nitpicks. But one thing I want to ask, because we're kind of wrapping up here. At the end, Kong has fallen down to his death. And it's kind of a beautiful scene of like the reporters. And then you see the, you know, pan out to see Kong. There's like a Rocky Adrian moment where everybody is surrounding Jessica Lange and she's crying and hysterical because of this trauma. Now Jeff Bridges is separated from her and it's like he's watching her as if he's not, they don't like end up in a sweeping embrace or something. It's almost like he's seeing like, this is kind of what you wanted. This is the fame and attention that you wanted. How does it feel? It almost feels like maybe this is in the extended cut or something, but it feels like there is some missing connective tissue there.
Well,
because it's a sad, it's a weird sad ending.
It is. It's really interesting because I think looking at it now and even the way you're describing it, it just seems like, look, you know, like we said, Kong was brought to this island of Manhattan, one island to the other, for capitalism, right? And so this is what capitalism and media at its worst does to whatever, you know, a person, a creature. And she's just swarmed by, you know, the reporters, TV crews, you know, onlookers, you know, and that's, you're right. That's just how it ends. And it's just like, it's kind of like, this is what humans, these people did to this amazing creature. And this is what she probably thought she wanted is all this attention, but then boom, this is what happens is she's just swarmed by all these people. And yeah, he's just kind of lost in the tide of all the chaos. And it's interesting. It's like, boom, credits just go up, you know, pans out. Yeah.
I like to think that Jack Prescott, the Jeff Bridges character, after this, he just became so despondent that he changed his name to Jeff Lebowski and just moved out to the beach.
Dude.
Went bowling.
Dude.
Yeah. Now, here's a question, because this is something my wife actually asked, and this will be the wrap-up point, because it's something that I could... It was one of those things where she was picking the movie apart when I wasn't quite ready for it to be picked apart. I'm like, I know, but come on.
There's plenty of time.
Right. But she did point out something that once she put that splinter in my brain, I'm like, damn it. What? This is kind of dumb. That big presentation with the gas, you know, gas pump
the reveal,
and all that.
Yeah.
Right. King Kong gets free. Jessica Lange, whom he ostensibly is in love with and ends up pursuing throughout the rest of the picture, she's standing right in front of him. And yet he decides to go off and start rampaging and attacking other people. What was that about? Why didn't
he's
he just
off, man?
But why didn't he like scoop her up and then go step on Charles Grodin
and then destroy those trains and other you know, because we needed more chaos in the city, you know.
I guess.
I thought that one kind of quiet moment in front of that Catholic Church was interesting. I'm like, I don't remember this. This is interesting. Because I just like, he's, I, it looks like the priest is like closing up and he exits the church and he's like, sees this giant, you know, ape walking down. I mean, it's New York. They shouldn't be surprised, right? Everything happens. I think it's just an excuse to, you know, have the an action sequence, you know.
Yeah, but it's just, it would be so much, so easily remedied where, you know, something snaps and she's set free and she runs in the other direction and then he's going after her and, you know,
right,
accidentally, right, or intentionally killing people. I don't know. What I loved about the Grodin kill is that you see the foot come down and then you see the... And then you see the foot come up, so you almost feel like you're just about to see the trampled body of Charles Grodin. Then it cuts. Like, nope, we're not going to show this to you.
No, that's part of the PG.
Yeah. What do you think is under there?
You could see a titillating waterfall scene with just Glenn, but you can't see flat Grodin.
So nice choice of words there, by the way. And appropriate. Yeah.
So a little bit of trivia before we leave. Originally, Meryl Streep was approached for this movie. She was deemed too unattractive by producer Dino De Laurentiis. Wow. And then she was also, they proposed that Barbara Streisand play her. They turned her down. Thank God. At the time, though, Lang was a New York fashion model and with no prior acting experience. So,
which is amazing to me. Considering where she, you know, would go on after this, but also it's a hell of a debut.
It is. It's really good. And John Gillerman, the British director who made this movie, he did actually direct the sequel, the 1986 sequel, King Kong Lives. And we got to track that down just for kicks. But he also did the last movie he did before this was The Towering Inferno. Did you ever wind up seeing that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I actually talked to Pat McDonald about that a few years ago.
Okay. Yeah. I do remember that. So that, to me, that was also an ABC Sunday night movie of the week, you know, Towering Inferno. It's like, so, you know, this, it's just, you know, funny that this is the director who did both of these movies. You know, again, I think Scream Factory did a pretty good job at, you know, providing us with some special features. I did watch, I think most of them. The Jack O'Halloran one's really interesting just because I think it's like, I don't know if you watched it, but I think it's like, a Zoom interview or something like that. And it's like, he couldn't figure out the video portion of it. It's just, it's really weird. I mean, the guy's old, but
it's a non-issue.
Yeah, it's a non-issue. But a lot of the people that are being interviewed are like executive producers, and, you know, no huge big names, but it would have been cool, especially like, you know, Charles Grodin recently died. Would have been cool to have some kind of, even if it was interviews from back in the day, you know. I love seeing those old footage from the 70s, you know. You know, he's on Johnny Carson. So what is this Kong thing you're doing? You know, that would have been fun. But yeah,
it is a great time capsule. And as I said, even if you are watching this and you're staying away because I got these new movies and the special effects are so much better, if your complaint, anybody out there, that is that the characters are all kind of lame and terrible in these new movies, go watch Kong 76, sort of block out the effects, you know, if that's such a problem, and focus on what they do with these characters. I mean, I almost think that they could do like a George Lucas style special edition where they just re-release this movie with state-of-the-art special effects, everything else intact, except maybe clean up a couple of those dodgy story points and, you know, have something really special.
Yeah, I agree. It would be interesting, but yeah, this was a huge thing, huge hit in the 70s.
Yeah. Well, and now I know why this is sort of on my odd bucket list of things like why have I never seen that movie. Now I got to see King Kong Lives and at some point the original King Kong. But David Folley, keeping it real, thank you again for talking with me. I have a feeling we're going to be talking about something else very, very soon. And then we'll be talking about something else even almost sooner than that. So, look forward, everybody out there, to more movie talk. And thank you, sir. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.